Okay. Hi, Judy.
Hi, Karis. Thanks for being here.
It's a pleasure.
I wanted to start by giving some context. It's been about a year and a half since I finished this research and published this scholarly podcast on podcasting platforms. And over the past few months, I have been working with the editors of BC Studies to publish this work in a forthcoming issue of the journal. I reached out to you to ask if you'd be willing to reflect with me on the making of this podcast and on some of the ongoing questions that the work raised during the peer review process. And I'm so grateful you were willing. As one of my mentors during this project, it feels quite fitting for me to include our dialogue in the work.
It's great to have a chance to reflect on this project again, and I want to say that I really appreciate the invitation.
Thanks so much. I wanted to start by introducing you to our listeners. Dr. Kara Shearer is the Associate Vice Principal Research and Innovation Pro Tem at UBC Okanagan, the Principal Research Chair in Digital Arts and Humanities, Associate Professor of English, and Director of the AMP Lab. Her research and teaching focus on literary audio, the literary event, the digital archive, book history, and women's labor within poetry communities. I've been so grateful to learn from you and your work, Karis, as I conducted this research in UBC Okanagan's Digital Arts and Humanities program and worked with you at the AMP Lab. To jump directly into reflecting on the podcast, I think you have some questions for me that we've prepared for this conversation.
I do. As we prepared for the conversation, you asked me to help you bring some of the questions that were raised in the peer review process into this epilogue and to share some of our ongoing reflections a year after the original publication of the podcast. We decided we wanted to briefly reflect on two things. One, the making of the podcast, especially as it relates to feminist methodologies and whose voices are included and not included in the interviews. And two, the importance of thinking of fire history as part of a history of colonialism in the midst of ongoing disastrous fire seasons.
That's right.
So, to start with the making of the podcast, one of the things that you've been hearing that listeners value about the podcast is how many different voices and kinds of expertise are represented in your interviews. Can you talk about how you selected these interviewees and what that has to do with feminist research methods?
These are questions I'm really glad to have the opportunity to reflect on. To start with some thoughts about my research design and methods. You and I talked so much about methods while I was engaged in this project. When I was seeking interviewees, I was reaching out to experts specifically, and I was especially hoping to bring in forms of expertise that are underrepresented in fire scholarship. This podcast was designed to be public from the beginning, which meant, among other things, that I wanted to take care in how I selected and represented my interviewees in the project. I decided to focus on expert interviews only, people who had spoken publicly about fire previously or contributed another relevant perspective on the Okanagan from their position of expertise. This was a way to accomplish my project of sharing interdisciplinary fire knowledges in a publicly accessible format and also protecting my project participants in terms of the kind of information I was asking them to share with the public. This might sound like pretty familiar journalistic practice to listeners on the one hand, but as academics listening will know, we have a lot of institutional ethics processes required by universities, and we take care when deciding not to anonymize research collaborators or participants in our work. Beyond basic institutional requirements, there's a deeper scholarship on feminist methods that you and I talked a lot about while I was doing this work, and I learned a lot by working with the AMP Lab, which is the feminist digital humanities lab that you direct at UBC Okanagan. In the AMP Lab, we spent a lot of time designing research methods with feminist values in mind, methods that work to acknowledge power dynamics between scholars and participants, methods that acknowledge risk to both scholars and participants of doing public humanities research, among other things.
I think that's really helpful context for your listeners. And I'm reminded of just how well your work aligns with the work that we do in the AMP Lab, even though, my research, as you know, is focused on poetry and archives. Both of us are thinking about power, institutions, and the way in which those institutions historically privilege white cis men, and the work that interventions that feminist scholars can make to amplify voices that are not typically heard. So I really appreciate the connection. One of the peer reviewers specifically wanted to hear why you didn't interview a Silk Okanagan expert directly for the podcast, given that Silk fire stewardship knowledge is so important to this research. Can you say more about that?
Yes, that was such a great question from that reviewer. They commented that they were appreciating the references to publications by Silk experts in my bibliography, which listeners can find published in the print edition of BC Studies. But this reviewer was left wondering why no Silk voices, aside from the short clip that we do here in the podcast of Pierre Kruger from the Good Fire podcast. That was a clip I used with their permission. The reviewer asked, what involvement, if any, did Silk communities have in this process? These are really important questions. And the reviewer is exactly right to note that the vast majority of the Okanagan Valley is the ancestral unceded territory of the Silk Okanagan people, and that more Silk perspectives would be a powerful addition to this project. During my research, Silk fire experts were some of the people I was most interested in talking to, and I reached out to a number of public-facing Silk experts to request interviews. And the people that I reached out to ultimately declined to be interviewed for this project. Importantly, I designed this project with the awareness that I was a settler living temporarily in the Okanagan on a relatively short research time frame. So it was never intended to bring new Indigenous knowledge into the public eye. It was intended to include expertise that communities had already decided to share. I was reaching out to people specifically in their capacity as public-facing experts who had already spoken or written publicly about fire knowledge. And as I reached out to potential participants, I was using that process of ongoing consent, a feminist method of care that we practice in the AMP lab, which was giving people many opportunities to say no to being interviewed, no to using parts of their interview in the work, and no to participating if they change their mind. And so, with that kind of framework in mind, knowing that I only had 2 years to work on this project, it made complete sense to me when I received kind and clear rejections from Silk experts who didn't have the interest or capacity to participate in the project or did not deem their knowledge and stories appropriate for a temporary settler researcher like me to include in a public format like this. So it was my job, as I saw it, to responsibly craft an audio story about the Okanagan that acknowledged those absences and presented itself as a partial story, not an exhaustive one. And I think the humility of acknowledging what is missing, even as I celebrate the important voices that I did gather together here, is a way to encourage ongoing questions, conversations, and more scholarship that can support healthier ways of living with fire in the Okanagan. And my interview and conversations with Shikwetmuk and Naklatmuk firekeeper and former wildland firefighter Jill Gilchrist was an important portrayal of Indigenous fire stewardship knowledge and firefighting knowledge from the southern interior of BC. But ultimately, that conversation took me outside of the Okanagan Valley to Naklatmuk territory in the Nicola Valley. I eventually made the subtitle of the podcast In and Around the Okanagan Valley to reflect its fluctuating scope. And one last thing I wanted to underscore in this kind of larger thinking about interviewees, is the fact that the people I interviewed come from different positions of influence and power when it comes to changing ways of living with fire. Sometimes I think that point gets obscured when I talk about this work and think about the many forms of expertise that are here or the many ways of knowing that this work celebrates. I think it is important to remember that they're not all on equal footing. And my work to put them together was not intended to erase the power dynamics and incommensurabilities that I think we can still hear at work, operating between them in the podcast.
One of the things I hear a lot in your work and what you've just said is about building or working at the speed of trust within the constraint of a degree, which is, obviously a challenge. And I think, your attention to boundaries and the word no is also, commendable. We talked about public scholarship as a feminist practice as well. How did that inform your work?
Yes. One of the main scholars that helped me see academic podcasting as a possibility is Dr. Hannah McGregor, who's a professor of publishing at SFU and the creator of the peer-reviewed podcast Secret Feminist Agenda. Hannah was also one of my supervisors for my research assistantship with the Spoken Web podcast, which is a podcast I was working on while I was doing the research for this project. And not only did Hannah's work give me published examples of the kind of deeply theorized, emotional, relational scholarship that I wanted to create in this FIRE research, but she helped me deepen my understanding of podcasting as a feminist practice. Something that Hannah talks about on Secret Feminist Agenda and in her lectures about academic podcasting is how the collaboration, conversation, feminist theoretical grounding, and the public-facing nature of her podcasting projects, this all makes them into powerful modes of feminist research. And when I was making this podcast, I was also learning from a lot of feminist theory that I was reading, not just hegemonic white feminism that erases difference, but plural feminist traditions, including understandings of engaged scholarship laid out by Black radical feminists like bell hooks and Audre Lorde, and indigenous feminist work by Jeanette Armstrong and Leanne Tosamasake Simpson. This was one of the gifts of doing this research in an interdisciplinary program in the digital arts and humanities. And for me, this podcast emerged from learning from those feminist values. I intentionally decided not to spend a lot of time talking about those theoretical foundations in the audio work itself, in the body of the podcast that listeners have just heard, just so that the story of the podcast remains focused on the material details of FIRE history and challenges. But my values are implicitly structuring that work, and I talk about them here and write about them elsewhere.
Yeah, and I'm reminded of how you surfaced them so beautifully in the written part of the thesis that comes with this. I want to turn the conversation to the connections between FIRE and colonialism and why making these connections is so important. Last summer, the summer of 2023, we experienced another record-breaking FIRE season in so-called Canada, in BC, in the Okanagan. The McDougall Creek wildfire in Kelowna occurred almost exactly 20 years after the 2003 Okanagan Mountain Park fire, which features centrally in your podcast to the story of Sharon Thiessen.
And I know you were there, Karis, during this fire, which I was watching with alarm on the news. Do you have any reflections to share, having been there during this historic wildfire event?
I do. I mean, I think, you know, as you know, Judy, I've lived in the Okanagan Valley for 12 years now, and I've seen a number of fires from a distance. This was the first time that I had ever lived through something that felt very, very close. I watched the fire when it was still on the west side and obviously worried very much about the people whose houses were under threat and structures that, you know, were eventually lost. I have never had a fire so close to, you know, where evacuation zones or evacuation alert zones were so close to my own house. I was very fortunate in the sense that I wasn't evacuated and was able to put up people who were evacuated from their houses. I didn't lose my house, and I feel, conscious of, you know, the kind of privilege that I have as someone who was outside of that zone, who had the means to leave if necessary.
Thanks for sharing those reflections. The 2023 fire season was humbling for people in the Okanagan, for people all across Canada who experienced evacuations and endangerment. Like I said, it was really disorienting for me to have worked on this project and this research with you and been living in the Okanagan, collaborating with many people on interdisciplinary fire research, but then to be ultimately watching this historic fire happen on the news from the safety of the coast where I'm now living on Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh territory in Vancouver. So I was very worried about everyone, and I'm really glad that you're safe.
To reflect on this in the context of the podcast, can you say more about why it's important to understand fire management as part of a history of colonialism as we continue to experience destructive fire seasons today?
Every life-threatening fire is another reminder that there is urgency in these questions of how to live well with fire for communities as we're confronting the legacies of land management in these places that burn, and as climate change will continue to fuel big fire seasons. Connecting fire history to colonial history in the Okanagan and in so-called British Columbia draws our attention to the power relations at work in fire governance and fire management. settler colonial governance structures and legal systems implemented from the late 19th century to the present day have attempted to dictate how fires should burn on these lands claimed by the province, British Columbia. They have attempted to dictate who's allowed to light fires and criminalize those who have resisted these colonial dictates. These legal systems have been deliberately constructed for colonial and capitalist reasons, and their ongoing colonial presence, to quote critical archival scholar Anne Stoller, impacts how fire can be managed and put to use today. I think when listening to your reflections on this disastrous fire in the Okanagan, when thinking about other fire disasters, this kind of historical awareness reminds all of us who care about building a healthier future on fire-prone landscapes that there are other ways to live with fire. Command and control fire suppression has not been the only way that people have lived with fire in the Okanagan. The histories and ongoing practices of Indigenous fire stewardship show us that. The history of how fire suppression became entrenched as a way to protect colonial property and timber profits shows us how these modes of relating to fire is tied to specific decisions to use forests as a globalized commodity instead of primarily as local places of sustenance, connection, and care. None of this is to disregard the important work of putting fires out when they threaten communities, when they threaten our homes, but it's to give historical context to the land management situations that we find ourselves in that are making these fires so disastrous. Understanding this history for me and including those connections in the podcast turns my attention to the ongoing strategies of Indigenous fire experts in the southern interior of BC, including Sealk, Sequetmuk, and Naklatmuk leaders, and also to ongoing forms of settler colonial land governance that make changing dominant socio-ecological relations so difficult.
Yeah, I believe one of your reviewers wanted to hear more about the political, bureaucratic, and economic barriers to Indigenous fire stewardship today. What's preventing Indigenous experts from putting more good fire on the ground?
My hope was that making these details of life with fire available to a wide audience would help motivate all of us to have these conversations. So it's a great question. I can recommend a great paper published by Kira Hoffman and her co-authors, published in 2022, called The Right to Burn: Barriers and Opportunities for Indigenous-Led Fire Stewardship in Canada. So that's a Canada-wide analysis, but they do identify five key barriers that I see as important for supporting cultural burning in the Okanagan and the southern interior. Those five barriers to putting more good fire on the ground are: one, key decision makers not understanding the relationships between Indigenous people and fire; two, the way colonial governments have the final say about wildfire management decision making on Crown land, which takes authority away from First Nations; three, a lack of training programs on cultural burning and accreditation opportunities outside of colonial governments; four, the risks and costs of fire insurance and liability when putting good fire on the ground; and five, the need for funding and capacity to revitalize Indigenous fire stewardship on lands that have been reshaped by colonial mismanagement.
That sounds like a really helpful paper.
It was really helpful to me. I wanted to also mention another paper by Marc-André Parisien and his co-authors. It's called Abrupt Climate Change Increases in Wildfires in British Columbia Since the Mid-2000s. It was published just last year in 2023. And it's about the more fire-conducive conditions faced by our communities in BC under climate change. I want to read a quote from that paper. They write, "Though daunting, the current conjecture in BC provides a strong impetus for accelerating efforts toward fire adaptation and mitigation that protect human communities and maintain essential ecosystem services within a broader climate change adaptation context. To take on this task, many tools are available. Landscape fire management plans enabling prescribed burning, Indigenous-led cultural burning, fuel mitigation treatments, optimization of forest harvesting and species conversions, as well as revised urban planning and building codes and practices, and enhanced preparedness and resiliency in fire and emergency organizations." They continue, "It is becoming evident that we require place-based efforts across firescapes that are both creative and sustained to confront the magnitude of the wildfire challenge in different socioeconomic and ecological situations across BC." So I read that because in reflecting on that quote and that call for action, this is something that I see coming from a lot of different kinds of fire scholarship. And this podcast was one attempt to contribute to a place-based effort and understanding to improve our relationship with fire-prone landscapes. I hope listeners in and around the Okanagan heard something resonant in this collection of expert interviews and personal oral histories of life with fire. And I hope as conditions continue to change in the Valley, they feel a little bit more prepared to talk about the role of fire in their communities after having listened to this work.
Thanks for that, Judy. As I'm listening to what you've said in our conversation, I'm really struck by the importance of doing public humanities work. The fact that your work you've chosen a different format, which is to say traditional scholarship tends to be published in written form, in expert papers that are not necessarily accessible to the wider public. And so in choosing a podcast format in which you are first amplifying voices that aren't traditionally heard in scholarship, you're rebalancing, but you're also reaching a different audience. You're also distributing and circulating that in a way that is free and much more widely accessible, which feels like a really important intervention in this topic in particular.
I really appreciate that. That was definitely an important aim of this project. And when I think about why this is so suited for a work in the public humanities vein, what messages I want the listener who is in the Okanagan or in a fire-prone landscape to take away, I'm just thinking about the current status quo of ignoring fire until these huge summer wildfires catch communities off guard. It doesn't have to be the way forward. That's one of the main lessons I hope listeners are taking from this, that we are living in fire-prone landscapes year-round, even when they're not burning. All of life on these landscapes can benefit from more of the right kind of fire at the right times of year, instead of these huge conflagrations during the summer. And I think this means thinking about whose interests dominate land governance decisions, to think back about those reflections on colonialism and what it means for that to still be a relevant conversation. What does it mean to recenter the long-term interests of human and the more than human communities in these places, and to learn from Indigenous fire stewards in that regard? If we who live in fire-prone places think about fire management and land care year-round and recognize the fire-prone nature of these ecosystems instead of reacting during these big wildfire disasters, it is possible to change dominant practices and ways of relating to the land and to each other. And those changes are already starting to happen.
Judy, thank you.
Thank you so much, Karis.